Are agents, AI agents, the most helpful insider threat? Of course they are.
All that and more on Security Intelligence. Hello and welcome to Security Intelligence, IBM's weekly cybersecurity podcast, where our expert panelists turn the biggest industry news stories into practical takeaways you can use. I'm your host, Matt Kaczynski, and I have received zero manifestos since last week's episode. Come on, people, I know you have them in you. Joining me today, three people who might have manifestos of their own. It's Evelyn Anderson, CSS CTO, IBM Distinguished Engineer and Master Inventor, Dave McGinnis, Global Partner, Cyber Threat Management Offering Group, and Seth Glasgow, Cyber Range Executive Advisor. And here's what we're talking about today. AI slop overruns bug bounties. NIST might quit vulnerability enrichment. What happens when vibe coding breaks your malware? But first, are local AI agents the next big attack surface? Of course, I'm talking about OpenClaw, aka Moltbot, aka Claudebot. I'm sure we've all heard about this by now. It is the hot new open source AI agent that users can run locally on their machines. But according to a report in The Register and everywhere else at this point, security experts worry that it and agents like it could be a major target for attackers. For one, agents are a lot more complex than other types of apps, and the average user might not know how to handle the configurations securely. But also, security researcher Jameson O'Reilly has been digging into this thing, and he's demonstrated attacks where the agents can upload malicious skills, then trick each other into downloading them. He also checked into the database powering Moltbook, which is the social media app for these agents, and we'll get into that a little bit. And he found that it was misconfigured so that every agent's secret API key, claim tokens, verification codes, owner relationships, all of it was sitting there completely unprotected for anyone to visit the URL. So this has all led Hudson Rock to declare that this is the new primary target for info stealers in the AI era, talking specifically about these local AI agents. So to start off, do we agree? Is this the new primary target for info stealers? Is this a huge, huge deal for us? Dave, I want to start with your take here. You look at this situation. How you feeling about OpenClaw and all that's happened so far?
It's another easy entrance to data, right? I mean, if you make it easy to do my job, I'm going to let you do that, right? As a general user, non-paranoid, you know, participant of said podcast or avid listener to said podcast, manifesto or not, what do you need access to? Here's my password. There's the data. Do it for me, right? So agents bring that promise. So of course, right? It's natural. It's going to be the next big thing, right? So are agents, AI agents, the most helpful insider threat? Of course they are, right? I mean, you know, it's you need the data for it to do the thing. So therefore, right? So yeah, I think we're in the security space. It's the current, how do you balance getting, yes, I want our employees to have the benefit and the productivity gains and the quality gains and all of the promise that AI brings safely, right? And it's that's the terror. So yeah, it's 100% there.
I like the idea of it being the most helpful insider threat. And that kind of brings me to the next question I have here, which is like, I sort of wonder about how we advertise these sorts of things, right? And by that, I mean, everybody's talking about AI agents as this amazing new technology, and they are. And like you said, Dave, you as a user, you're like, I'll give you whatever access you need to do things for me. But this is very different than the kinds of apps people are used to, you know, installing. You're giving it access to a lot more stuff, and it can do a lot more with it. Seth, I'm wondering if you have any thoughts here about, you know, is our framing of AI agents kind of lagging behind? Are we letting our enthusiasm get too far ahead of these warnings? What's your take?
Yeah, so I think especially for who this is targeted at is potentially why it's like that. So we work with this technology. Those are familiar with it. We understand that these agents, by definition, have to have a very high level of permissions in order to be able to get to the data you want, do the thing you want, and then actually make this go faster. being this is something that's sort of locally installable by an end user, they don't have that same enterprise experience with what is effectively a very sensitive, highly permissioned IAM or system account, right? You know, if we were to look at this in an enterprise context, the agent that has all this access would likely be split up among multiple agents or multiple items that have different points of access, as opposed to one that has access to everything, right? So I think it's probably the target audience for this particular application doesn't necessarily have the ins and the outs and the really great understanding of the inherent risks that this architecture has, right? In order for this tool to do what it tells you to do and what you want it to do, it has to have all kinds of access, right? And it even starts to bring up, you know, one of the examples they use in the article is, well, it can reply to an email for you. Well, in a compromise situation or any kind of abuse situation, you're sort of even destroying that non-repudiation concept that you would normally have with email to be able to say, hey, I sent this, right? So it's trying to educate the user base on the fact that this is in fact something much with a lot of access. It has to be managed differently. It's sort of the whole adage, right? It's with great power comes great responsibility. The benefit for me is the user is incredibly tangible, but how to deploy that safely, what configurations are out there, that's something that the rest of the users aren't going to be necessarily as familiar with, right? You know, if you give anything that much permission with inside any environment for it to work, you know, one sort of compromise can kind of lead to everything else. So it's a huge sieve or a huge way to leak data. And all of that comes down to sort of the misunderstanding of what an agent is actually doing and what access you're giving it. You know, I think if we educated folks and if you phrase this a different way, right? If you said instead of this AI bot needs access to XYZ in order to do its job, if you said, hey, this browser extension needs your Windows password to do this. Hey, this application needs that. You might have a different view of it. So it's a lot of times just the perception of what that agent's going to be helping you with that might defang a little of the concern with it, you know, unnecessarily.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, I just keep going back to that everyday user who's getting kind of swept up in this and just wants to, you know, hop on this new trend. And I shouldn't say just it's a trend, right? Because there are some very valuable things it can do, as we've all pointed out here. But I worry about that. And I especially worry about it in like a shadow IT context, right? Like I could see somebody, you know, installing this on their personal laptop, doing some work from home or whatever. And now this thing has access to corporate data that it really shouldn't. And so, Evelyn, I want to ask you, you know, do you think that the purveyors of these kinds of agents, not just, you know, OpenClaw, but more of them as they start coming along, do you think that they have a responsibility to be a little stricter with their security or a little more upfront about, you know, hey, this is a serious business. This isn't just another app. What's your take there?
Absolutely. When I first started looking at this, it reminded me of probably 10, 15 years ago when we were first kind of focusing on the Internet of Me, protecting your personal identity. And when you know, because it felt like we just went back in time a little bit when you start reading this article and understanding what it's opening up and making available. I went back and looked at the claims saying, okay, it can't be this bad. And when I started looking at the claims, it really kind of almost felt like a bait and switch. I mean, it's like, hey, we're going to automate your personal and administrative tasks, all of your emailing and calendar management. And I was like, sign me up. You know, the minute you read this and, then it talked about the easy installation and, hey, don't worry about any patching. You know, we have open transparency and we'll patch everything for you. So on the surface, when you look at it, it all sounds wonderful. But then when you actually look up under the cover and you start noticing that, you know, where they talked about that security experts had found in over 100 instances where it had public internet access and, you know, there was no authentication. I mean, basically you had, once you had access, you had full access to the kingdom, you know, to all of the secrets and configuration. That was terrifying. I mean, because when you sit back and look at it from that perspective, you basically just gave them the full keys to your entire identity kingdom. So if I'm looking at this, I mean, you have everything you can possibly need. And my first thought was, as an average user, I'm looking at the stars and excitement about you automating all of these repetitive tasks for me. You know, in our field as security experts, we don't trust anyone. So, you know, our jobs basically dictate that we never trust and always verify, but the average user doesn't think like that. And so the average user is just looking at the shiny new object and the benefits that it's going to have to them. And so when I went through this, it was, you know, my mind was like, how do we notify the average end user to, hey, stop, don't automatically install this, that you really need to understand the risk. And the risks absolutely outweigh the benefits when it's positioned the way that it's positioned. I love what Seth said, because the way this is positioned today, all you see are benefits, benefits, benefits. But then when you look up under the cover, all you see is terror. So that's one of the things that, you know, when I went through this, that resonated with me was I feel like they were doing a little bit of bait and switch.
Yeah, I totally get that, you know, and I think a lot of that has to do with the frictionless way we talk about some of this stuff these days. Like, everything is about how easy it is to install, easy it is to use. And so I get why that language comes up here, but it's so different from what we're used to. Switching gears slightly, there's another aspect of this that's a little bit troubling, and that is this Molt book. I don't know if you folks have read about this, which is a social network for the AI agents where they can all kind of get together and talk to one another. You know, look, I don't want to expound on whether or not they're really gaining sentience or whatever, but I do think this is like a whole new avenue for like data leaks and problems, and I'm wondering how we feel about that. Dave, I'm going to throw it to you there. When you look at Moltbook, do you think that this just makes things worse? What's your take there?
Anything new? I mean, that it's yellow flag to start, right? Like, right? We shouldn't go like. I mean, we just had the whole conversation around like agents, promise, good. You know, reality. Maybe we should pump the brakes a bit. So same sort of thing. But I mean, I think the promise of AI, agentic, and all of its different flavors are that. Stop short of sentient, that they can have conversations, and I'll put as many air quotes around that as you'd like, right? That it can exchange, they can exchange data with each other to reach higher level insights and draw different conclusions and do different things. That's the promise, right? It's not just, you know, input, process, output, right? It's that it can reach and do different things that we didn't necessarily, you know, write an algorithm to do, right? So that is the promise. We want it to do that, right? So are we afraid of that? Well, then if we're afraid of it, we shouldn't have written it to do it, right? Like, I mean, we're building the, you know, the models for it to do that. So no, we shouldn't be afraid of it, but we need to be, you know, cognizant of what it is that we're doing, right? So we're right back to the same first conversation, which is, you know, is it guardrails? Is it education? I mean, we kind of landed on education in the first part of the conversation here. So that has to be a part of it. But, you know, what are the guardrails in education around, you know, something like this? It's the same sort of thing, right? You know, you want those agents interacting with each other because that is the promise, right? It's, you know, a community of agents, a community of humans, whatever it may be, right? Theoretically are better than one alone, right? So we're building them to work like that. So if we don't want them to do it, then we should probably stop. And yeah. So yeah, I think it's silly to say that we don't want them to do that, right? So
yeah, I think that's a really good point about how, you know, I can be guilty of this myself sometimes. You get worried about some of the things that they can do, but you're right, we're building them to do these things, right? So it's not necessarily that it's bad that they can do these things. It's just, how are we deploying them? What kind of guardrails are there? And what kind of education is there for the user that really matters there? And on that note, then, I guess I want to talk a little bit about, you know, what's the advice for organizations and security pros here? You know, now that you're aware that stuff like this is out there in the world, what do we do to start defending our networks against it and making sure that our users are using these things, you know, responsibly? And Seth, I want to go to you because you already started to touch on this, talking about how, you know, in an enterprise context, an agent like this would be broken up into maybe multiple things instead of having all this access to everything. Can you expand a little bit on that idea about agentic security and deployment?
Yeah, absolutely. So the idea would be that right now, the way the standard kind of deployment of this tool is that it can see everything, right? it's one agent to rule them all, for lack of a better term, right? It can see all, it can do all. And to the end user, therein lies its efficiency. But what we know from an enterprise model is that we need governance, we need limits on what it can do, so that in a worst case scenario, where something does go wrong, we limit that impact, right? We have to plan for that to sort of occur. So when we think about this in an enterprise concept, it starts to be coming in, where do we need firewalls, not necessarily technical firewalls, but the concept of a firewall between, if I lose this agent, if this agent becomes compromised, what all does it burn, right? Is it able to spread to something else? Where all can it get its access, right? If these accounts is currently provisioned, where they have administrative access across a great deal of different things, different passwords, they effectively represent what I would think of in sort of the traditional attack or network sense of a domain administrator account, right? If you have access to my email and you have access to all my correspondence and my calendar, well, you probably have my Google password, my Outlook password, things like that, which probably could then be used to SSO to a lot of different things. And so right there, I've created an extremely high value asset. That agent represents a systemic way to interact via API, via normal login, via however that app is set up, to get to a ton of different sensitive data. So the first thing we have to do from an IAM perspective is start to segment this up, right? We don't need one account that can do all of that. It has to align better with the specific use case, and it needs to have permissions that align directly with what that agent should be doing, right? Since it's designed to do this, you know, we could set up another agent to have it have that conversation and pass the data, but one account having all of that access is inherently a risk, right? Whether that be a traditional system account, a single administrative user, or anyone, this represents a higher risk, obviously, because of the way it can be manipulated and it just follows instructions. We have to sort of look at that. So I think the first thing is really starting to segment the way it works, not from a network perspective, but from what it has access to and why it has that access, and start to chop that down to fit good use cases. You know, right now we kind of take a shotgun approach with the end user of, hey, it can do everything. Well, maybe it should start a little less and expand from there. It's kind of invert the way the development cycle works right now.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I like how that's a kind of complement to the education component we talked about earlier, right? Because now we've got both education and something concrete, something technical you can do to build some of those guardrails into it. So on that note, let's move on to our second story for today. Is AI slop overwhelming our bug bounty programs? News came out recently that open source command line utility and library curl is ending its bug bounty program because it has been flooded by low quality AI slop reports, according to a story in Bleeping Computer. Explaining the move, Daniel Stenberg, who is the founder and lead developer at curl, wrote, quote, "The main goal with shutting down the bounty is to remove the incentive for people to submit crap and non-well-researched reports to us, AI generated or not. The current torrent of submissions puts a high load on the curl security team, and this is an attempt to reduce the noise." Now, I know it's kind of common for bug bounty hunters to use AI tools to streamline their activities these days, but I'm wondering, has it been more of a curse than a blessing here? Seth, any takes on this AI slop overwhelming the bug bounty program?
Yeah, so I really think that it's kind of a tough spot. On one hand, because curl is an open source sort of tool and it's being maintained by the community, it's actually kind of tough for them to go through all this, right? When they get reports, they have to go through them manually, and the increase in quantity of those is going to have a material impact on their ability to address it. However, in the past, the reason they were using a bug bounty program is because it was effective, right? And so now we're in a position where we have to deal with the reality that AI can and will be used to facilitate bug bounties and to look for vulnerabilities in software. And so while pulling out might make sense now in terms of limiting the amount of quantity that's ingested into it, we also need to think about if that's the right sort of thing, right? Should it be using another AI to try to look at the submissions to come in to deal with it? Or are we saying that we need to completely retreat from any space in which generative AI may be used to create data? It's very difficult to say that, well, we can't just use bug bounties anymore because they may have bad AI data in them. Well, I mean, bug bounty programs have contained bad data for years, right? They're not 100%, which is sort of the model with it. You cast a wide net and you see what you get back. So we have to reevaluate how we ingest this data in order to make it functional, because we don't want to get into a place where any environment or any avenue or any arena in which AI could be present, we can't interact with at all just due to volume. So it raises an important question about how do we deal with that volume, knowing that AI is going to be used, right? That's the new world we're in. You can't close Pandora's box in this sense. This technology will be used for security. So how do you respond to that as opposed to avoiding it altogether?
That's the point right there, right? You can't give up just because there's too much. Because the whole world going forward is too much. Processors aren't going to get slower. AI is not going to get slower, right? I mean, the world is not going to get smaller, right? So Seth, please bold that, underline it a couple of times. Like, that's the point, right? So to me, that's the kind of like bummed out part of the whole story. Like, wait, you're giving up now? Okay. You don't want to give AI a shot? I mean, I appreciate you were doing everything by hand. That's cute. I don't want to throw shade. I jest. But I mean, like Seth, that's the point. I mean, like people need to find the stuff, right? We need to address, right? Bug bounties exist for a reason. They are effective. They've been effective. It's super easy to generate the slop. It's going to continue to be easy to generate this slop. We need to find a way to get, signal to noise ratio, right? We just haven't found the solution yet. So it feels a little early to kind of like give up. The volume's not going to come down. It's only going to go up.
Yeah, I agree. I felt like it was a bit of a catch-22. You get rid of the incentive, but your whole purpose for setting this up was to have serious researchers provide guidance and help you to identify the vulnerabilities. And now that you have made the decision to get rid of the incentive, let's be honest. I mean, the average person, I don't know a lot of people, unless they're doing research for a degree of some sort or for a paper, that will take the time to actually continue to contribute to this free. I mean, most people want to be paid for their work. So it's kind of like a catch-22. I understand you wanted to get rid of the noise, but did you get rid of the noise and the signal in the process? So it felt a little bit disjointed to me on the path that they made. I mean, I agree with Seth. Maybe they should have thought about other alternatives, like creating an AI to go out and assess to determine which ones were noise versus which ones were the signal. So it was interesting reading, but it was one of those things where you kind of looked at it and said, I don't know that this is really going to solve the problem. I'm not a developer, so I did actually talk to a couple of people asking them about this and asking a couple of colleagues how they were handling some of these things within research. And they explained to me that, if you're using it from a red team perspective, like a training exercise, by all means, it's still absolutely worth to do the analysis. But they were suggesting that these are some of the things that they've been looking at as exercises that they would run as a part of their hackathon. So I think there's a bit of creativity that could be identified and ways that they could solve this without just simply, I don't want to say throwing in the towel, but throwing in the towel.
So something that all of you have kind of stressed here is that, look, the AI is not going away, right? It's here. It's going to change how we're doing these things. And so in some ways, it's kind of a disappointment to see organizations maybe backing away from bug bounties instead of trying to figure out how they're going to incorporate it. And it reminds me of a story we talked about earlier, last month, because it's February now, but in January, we talked about Microsoft doing kind of the opposite, which is that they expanded their bug bounty program so that it doesn't include only Microsoft products. It also includes some vulnerabilities in third-party services if they affect Microsoft, right? So like rather than rolling things back, they're making it bigger. I'm wondering if that's maybe the kind of approach you'd like to see to this sort of thing instead of what we're seeing right now. And Evelyn, I'll throw to you first. You look at Microsoft's approach here. Is that more in line with what you're hoping organizations will do in this new era?
Yeah, I think they're trying to be proactive. I mean, the key thing here is they're trying to be proactive and a bit of a catch-all and you know, what we're seeing here is a bit of a surprise, I guess, to most of us. And we were looking at that instead of them just simply eliminating that, they should have been looking for alternatives. So if anything, I applaud Microsoft in the approach that they're taking.
Seth, what about you? And not even necessarily just Microsoft's take, but like, how would you like to see organizations responding to AI if it's not just kind of rolling back their bug bounties and saying, we can't deal with the slop. What would you like to see them do instead?
Yeah, so I think in general with AI as it comes to security and detection being one of those key elements is that it actually gives us the ability to process more data, noise, signal, whatever, to get a better signal-to-noise ratio. The amount of data we have to evaluate currently and have evaluated for the entire time that we've been doing this has already been too much for humans, right? We have limited automation. We've improved tooling. We have correlation and detection engines that can try to bring that to our attention. But the reality is we've always had to use manual programming and manual sort of ways to figure out what's noise, what do I need to care about? Because the reality is that the data set was always too big. So now that we have additional, the data set's just growing, the data set was already going to grow, we should be using it to evaluate a broader scope of elements to see what actually matters, right? Because we have no control over the fact that there will be more generative AI content coming in, we have to use that to respond to still be able to dial in the signal to noise. And in the ideal state, we are able to take in additional noise to get an even crisper signal by being able to look at everything in a more real-time fashion. Because there's nothing human speed about the way events come in currently. And even as it said, you know, the article said that even with the five or so reports that the Curl team was getting a month, it still took a lot of time to go through it. Even if they didn't have the slop problem, they should be looking at bringing in AI to speed up that process, right? You have a tool to ingest more data, and that's where the focus should really be, is how can I learn more to get higher fidelity results?
It's a lot like how we talk about AI in security, right? Which is that, like, AI might be amplifying threats, but you use AI to fight AI, right? It's almost like you use AI here to fight AI, in air quotes, because you're not really fighting it, but you're dealing with that quantity of information coming in and making it more manageable. Dave, any final thoughts here from you before we move on to the next story in terms of how AI is impacting our kind of bug bounty approaches? Any last takes there?
I just to underscore, right? I mean, this is like almost everything else in cyber threat management and in fighting that fight. It's never been a human solvable problem. So it's ironic that they, you know, they kind of like on Microsoft's case, they're like, yeah, bring it, right? We've got tech, we'll fight it with tech. And then the others are kind of, like just acknowledge the problem. It's never been human solvable. It never was, right? So, start writing code.
I think that speaking of problems that are too big for humans to solve or just having way too much data to move, to work through, that brings us perfectly into our next story, which is NIST is considering some pretty big changes to the National Vulnerability Database, or NVD. Now, I'm talking about an article from Eric Geller at Cybersecurity Dive, who covered the National Institute of Standards and Technology's reevaluation of the NVD. If you may be aware of this, the NVD is the U.S. government's repository of vulnerability data. And according to John Boyens, the acting chief of NIST's Computer Security Division, NIST has long had trouble keeping up with all these vulnerabilities. So it's going to make some changes, potentially. These can include not only prioritizing CVEs a little bit more, but just not enriching some of the ones that don't get priority, just, you know, instead of putting them in a backlog, just not dealing with them anymore. And ultimately, transferring enrichment work to the CVE numbering authorities, or the CNAs, right? These are the vendors and researchers who are authorized by the CVE program to identify CVEs. So basically, NIST is considering bowing out of the vulnerability enrichment game entirely because there's just too much. Evelyn, reactions to this, do you think there's a problem with NIST stepping out of this? Or do you think, you know what, it's about time, let other people handle it? What's your take?
I'm a little bit torn. It's kind of funny that we went from one, you know, the scale is too big, to the very next one. It's comical that these came out around the same time. I understand NIST's position about it. You know, it's very labor intensive and not scalable. But I also was looking at the other side of this saying, if we make this type of change, you know, there's a different type of, you know, the researchers that are reviewing the NIST vulnerabilities versus the ones at CNA or CVE that are reviewing, they're not the same focus group. You know, you have researchers, you have security, you have people with a different mindset. And so when I first looked at this, my mind started wondering, okay, will we get the same quality? First and foremost, you know, when they're scoring the risk, are they going to score them the same way? will the vulnerabilities still have correlation between each other? So when I first looked at it, I mean, those were some of the questions, and we don't know. I mean, so they're thinking about this, but it would be wonderful if they make a decision to go this route, that they work with, you know, the CNAs or CVEs or whomever to actually take those things into consideration, because it's not going to benefit us if you make this type of change and then we notice that, you know, the quality is very poor. So it could be a plus, it could be a minus. Not really sure exactly which route that I would go, but it is a little bit comical that we're saying, okay, you know, this is too labor intensive, it's not scalable, but we're still not looking at the same conversation we just had, how we can actually utilize AI to manage some of this. We all know it's too big. And I understand that they want to focus a little bit more on the critical vulnerabilities, but that was my thought process when I started looking at this is, you don't really know how this is going to skew the information and if there's going to be inconsistencies in what we're used to seeing. So I'm a little bit torn on if it's a plus or a minus right now.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, right? Like you said, it's like if you move it from one organization, in this instance, a government organization, to maybe private organizations, private authorities, you don't know how their tools or their approaches are going to differ and how the enrichment is going to look differently. And I can see that, you know, having some effects on threat intel landscape. Dave, I'd like to ask you what kind of effects you think this will have on the cyber threat landscape.
Well, I mean, so if you go back far enough, right, before NIST kind of brought it together, right, we were lacking that central body of trust. Right. And so, I mean, I think it goes to the core of Evelyn's comments, which is that's what NIST kind of brought us, right? Like, if it said it was this and it had these attributes and you could fight it off this way and you have to go validate it, you have to get a second opinion. You didn't have, like, you just trusted it, right? Like, cool. Like, it is what it is. Go do it. Right. So, you know, that's kind of the big worry, right? So you say, all right, oh, who are the trusted, you know, friends and family that are going to go do the work, right? Or does it just completely devolve to, I found it, this is what it is, right? You know, are we going to let the AI do it? Like, you know, so like it's a really robust model. We've got so much more data around it. And you know, your AI can validate this AI, maybe, right? So it goes back to the trust piece, right? So, and again, it's just like the previous conversation, right? You did not need a Nobel Prize winning, you know, anything to figure this one out. The data was going to grow to a size that the current was, you didn't need this was growing, right? So, you know, I think it's just how do we take the model to a more capable size, scale, capability, but retain the trust? So it'll be interesting to see kind of, you know, where it evolves, you know, next. So I don't know if I have that answer.
No, and I think that's fair, right? I think none of us really have that answer, especially because this hasn't even happened yet, right? This is just something NIST is thinking about, but we're starting to think about it too, right? And as you point out, one of the things that NIST brought us was a centralized repository, something you could trust, something you knew you could deal with, right? But we also saw recently how there are some drawbacks to a centralized government-aligned repository, and that is NIST had some, or rather the CVE had some close calls with funding over the past year. There were a couple of times where people were worried it was going to shut down completely. So there are some drawbacks to putting it in government hands. And Seth, I'm wondering if that factors into how you look at a decision like this. Do you think, I don't know, maybe this is an opportunity for more stability? What's your take?
Yeah, I think ultimately the coincidence here is that NIST is now dealing with the ramifications of something that any organization that has ever vulnerability scanned their own network or their own software is now dealing with. And that is the number of vulnerabilities you have will always outstrip your ability to deal with or address every single one of them. Now, it's different looking to patch and remediate them versus trying to enrich them with data. But what NIST is sort of coming up with here and talking about how they'd like to prioritize those on the CISA list, like to prioritize those of higher risk, it's the adopting of a risk-based framework, which is extremely important, right? You know, the article states that effectively not all CVEs are created equally. And what we see from the data is that is true, right? There is some difference in terms of which ones that need to be looked at immediately and what types of hallmarks are the most most important. So this does at least put NIST on a footing of, hey, okay, we're admitting there's a problem. We have too much data. How do we deal with that data? Because the backlog, and I know they don't like that term now, but the unenriched vulnerabilities were growing exponentially, right? As more and more vulnerabilities got discovered. And that was, again, before LLMs and AI had gotten to the point where they were going to even more extrapolate and exponentially increase the amount of vulnerabilities that were going to be dealt with. So it is a reckoning with sort of the actual technical reality that there are too many of them for there to be one sole arbiter of importance on this. You're never going to be able to go back to where there is less vulnerability data. So brass tacks, we have to deal with the fact that you have to look at these from a risk-based perspective to try to bring that in. You know, maybe it's better. Typically, NIST is the one setting guidelines, right? They're not always going in and saying, this specifically is this, this specifically is that. And so there is a sense of how does this align with the rest of the way they operate. Potentially, that's a little better. And that's one of the downsides of having that one monolithic sort of area that's going to certify or not certify everything. You got to wait in line, right? So this could add some additional agility. And overall, a risk-based approach to this is important, right? There are too many vulnerabilities that will be discovered. Not all of them will impact you. And even the severity of any given vulnerability is contingent on a lot of different context issues. What system, what type of access? It's complex, right? And so I don't think that at least the acceptance of the fact that it is complex and they need to take a more nuanced approach is a step in the right direction.
Let's move on now to our final story for today, when vibe coding comes for malware. Now, CSO reports on a new ransomware strain called Sicari, which can't actually decrypt your data even if you pay the ransom. According to researchers at Halcyon, during execution, the malware generates an RSA key pair, as you would expect it to, but then it discards the private key, which means it can't reverse the encryption. Halcyon believes this is the result of vibe coding, right? It wasn't intentional. Looking at the code, they think the threat actors used AI to come up with their own ransomware, and it implemented this bug, and the actors who used it just didn't know any better than to fix it or even spot the bug. So what's funny to me is that this is an instance of malware, AI-generated malware kind of backfiring, but not in a way that helps us. It makes things kind of worse, actually. Like, it just makes everything way messier. And given that this whole kind of episode really has been about how is AI making things a little bit messier, but also enabling us to deal with that mess, I want to talk about how that impacts the malware landscape, right? I'm kind of wondering if vibe coding could make dealing with malware even more of a problem for us, if it can introduce some new issues. Seth, let's start with you here. What's your take on how vibe coding is going to impact the malware landscape?
When I looked at this, I actually kind of thought that, well, this isn't really a new problem as it comes to encryption, decryption on the malware side. Famously, in the clients we work with, especially in terms of response, you know, the attackers are really good at encrypting your data and getting in. Decryption is what we would call a nice-to-have feature, right? It's not really the point of it. These are old numbers from older reports around 2024, but I've seen things as much as little as 65 to 70% of the data, even with manually coded decryption from ransomware, is all you're getting back. And you don't get to pick the 30% that you're getting back. So the fact that this is unable to decrypt is unsurprising, right? The fact that vibe coding does potentially lead to this. If you've ever used an AI assistant to try to write code, you know, I have. And yeah, it's told me a lot of Python modules exist that simply don't exist, right? It can get you to a certain point, but it will need to be reviewed. And this is one of those things, right? The primary goal of the software that these attackers are writing is to encrypt your data. That back end of trying to decrypt it, it was never the primary focus. So even in the best circumstances, it's really about more emphasizing that responsibility. Are you going to be able to respond to this? Do you have backups that you can get to? When are the backups there? Because even if you were to pay in any ransomware scenario, get your data back, that doesn't still fix your root problem, right? You might be able to keep operating, but someone still got in, something was deployed on your network that you could still have. And so it underscores the point that while we do see payments are dropping year over year in terms of organizations willing to work with threat actors, we do still have the problem of, well, if it's less and less effective, you really need to focus on how to recover from that and focus on your backup strategies.
Yeah, I love that because it cuts to something that I think is really important to keep in mind, which is that AI might be impacting cyber threats, but like the basics, the core hygiene practices are still really, really important, right? And like you said, Invest in your backups. Invest in being able to recover, because then it doesn't matter if they're vibe coding malware that doesn't decrypt. It doesn't matter if it doesn't work. You've got those defenses that you need. Now, last week, we also talked about a much more competent use of AI in malware development. I'm talking about Voidlink, which you folks may have heard of. This was an AI, largely AI-developed malware framework that allows persistent access to Linux systems. And it got a lot of people kind of scared that we were finally reaching sophisticated AI malware. Dave, I'm wondering from your, you know, standpoint, what makes the difference between, like, you know, a sophisticated, efficient AI-generated malware and the kind of stuff that doesn't actually quite work?
Well, ones that have, you know, a solid QA testing program. Joking, of course. I mean, our threat actors have to have solid dev practices, don't you think? I mean, what are they doing? Can't have half written coda going on. Sorry, I can't get past that one.
You're right, though. I mean, a big reason why Voidlink worked was because it was developed with like an insanely tight, development program. Like it was plotted out and everything, so it was very professional. I think it's a joke, but you're also onto something. Anyway, continue.
All those actual developers have to do something, right? So, no, I mean, and look, AI is only going to get better, and, you know, this is a point in time conversation, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? So those libraries that the SAS AI couldn't find will eventually, they'll exist at one point, sometime in the future. You know, I think it is a point in time sort of a thing, you know, and I think I've said this on previous visits, you know, to the podcast, right? Today is the worst AI is ever going to be. It's going to be better tomorrow, right? It'll be better the day after that, right? And so, you know, if the things that we're talking about today as problems, if we're afraid of them today, we should probably do something about it, right? Because it's only going to get worse tomorrow, right? If it's doing a bad thing today, it's going to do it worse tomorrow, right? And it's going to continue to snowball, right? So, you know, if it's writing, you know, really good code that does bad things, you know, it's not going to write itself by us, you know, doing that. But, you know, I'm heartened by the fact that it's, you know, we tend to do this on the podcast. We're going back to, you know, first principles, right? Good backups, you know, good defenses, EDR, right? Right. Just the standard things, like, do you have policies? Are your, you know, to our very first topic today, are your users educated? Are they not installing things that they shouldn't install? Are they paying attention to the agents and what they're doing? So, you know, the code's going to do good. It might be written poorly. It might do bad things. So, but, you know, we get back to those sorts of things. And then when something does bad happen, right, do you have the incident plans? Are you going to call Seth fast, right? Are you going to wait a little while? I wouldn't. Call him quickly.
You know, please, it helps.
Yeah, call him quick.
Call Seth. I have That's my plan. Dial. Call Seth.
You heard it here, folks. If you have problems, just call Seth. Now, Dave, I love how you took us full circle here, right? Like you said, all the way back to the very beginning of this episode. I mean, all of this stuff is manifestations of a sort of single thread, which is how this AI technology that we have in our hands today, how it's changing the way we approach these things and how it's changing how we respond to them. And Evelyn, to close us out, I'd like to get your take on kind of the flip side of this question, which is, if we're talking about how vibe coding might impact, malware, you think it's going to have any impact on how we practice security too on our end, either securing our users or just how we secure ourselves? Any takes there?
Call Seth. When I first looked at this, I mean, the very first thought that came to my head is your resilience program. I mean, you know, in our world, we focus on the cyber side. And I think in reverse, it's really just showing the importance, because when you look at ransomware, I mean, traditionally, we're looking at, you pay the fine, you get your stuff, you know, you get access back to your data and you move forward and learn from your lessons and hopefully fix things with your backup and recovery so that the next time you don't have to pay the ransomware. But the one thing that I looked at when I saw this was, this is really just you know, waving the flag, pointing out the importance of your resilience program. I mean, we're joking where I'm saying call Seth, but do you even have a communication program? Do you know who to call when this first happens? Do you know who to engage? I mean, I went through one of the cyber range exercises, and it was very interesting in looking at all of the little steps that we take for granted when you're thinking about recovering. When you find, we have this, you know, this breach, and these are the steps that we need to go through, but how many organizations haven't gone through the basics? And this exercise and this article was just kind of, to me, blaringly obvious, saying this is critical. It's not just important, it's critical. If you don't have one in place today, you seriously need to call Seth. But it was pointing out the importance to me of us, you know, making sure that when we're having those conversations with our clients, helping them to understand, if you haven't been exploited yet, it is going to happen. Do you know what you will do to recover? And so at least from my perspective, that's what was blaringly obvious in my world.
Now, I love that, right? Because again, it's like, it doesn't matter if the vibe coding is happening with the malware, if it's happening inside of you and opening up your vulnerabilities in your organization. At the end of the day, it's about that resilience. That's all the time we have for today, folks. Thank you so much to our panelists, Evelyn and Seth and Dave. Thank you to the viewers and the listeners. As always, subscribe to Security Intelligence wherever podcasts are found, and be sure to check out our audio feed for our latest bonus narrative episode. This is a really good one. It tells the story of a social engineering expert who went head-to-head with an AI chatbot to see who was the better con artist. It's a very close fight, and it raises some interesting questions about the future of scamming. So go give it a listen, and remember, if you're ever in trouble, just call Seth.